production, July 6, 2003, of Bathrop Spears Broadsides, Civil Rights in Santa Cruz. What a concept. Stay with us.
The homeless, our problem, for only one reason. Their president raises the question, who owns the land? The homeless, our problem, for only one reason. Our president raises the question, who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Could it be 90 million dead Indians? Who owns the land? Could it be 6 million Jews? Who owns the land? Is there a connection? Who owns the land? To all imperialism? Who owns the land? Won't someone please tell me? Who owns the land? I am just a white man. Who owns the land? I live in the Americas. Who owns the land? How did I get here? This morning, I was awoken by a man with a handgun. He's got a book of rules that says I ain't got no right to sleep. This morning, I was awoken by a man with a handgun. He's got a book of rules that says I ain't got no right to be. Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Could it be that there's a connection? Who owns the land? To my daily eviction. Who owns the land? And the extermination. Who owns the land? Of the Native American. Who owns the land? Won't someone please tell me? Who owns the land? 'Cause I am just a white man. Who owns the land? I live in the Americas. Who owns the land? How did I get here? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Maybe it's me and you. Maybe it's not the corporation. Maybe the earth owns its own self. Maybe it's the Native America. The homeless are a problem for only one reason. My president raises a question, who owns the land? The homeless are a problem for only one reason. Your president raises a question, who owns the land? Ecocide, genocide, where is home? Ecocide, genocide, where is home? Ecocide, genocide, where is home? Ecocide, genocide, where is home?
And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Bathrop Spears Broadsides, as mentioned before. The long version. I'm your host, Robert Norse. And I plan a couple of interviews today which might interest folks out there. The subject matter for this show, as mentioned before, is civil rights in Santa Cruz and concerns ranging from CPS abductions to police misconduct, to the gentrification of the mall, to the city council's latest depredations, to the implications at a more at a broader level, nationally and internationally. The war in Iraq, which is raging, of course, even as Führer Bush has promised us the war is over, even as the Democrats are clucking and clucking, but no one's calling except perhaps for Kucinich for an actual withdrawal of U.S. troops, as U.S. troops are getting shot down and shooting down Iraqis, escalating the conflict. You have Bush rattling the drums of war against Iran. And you also have, it sort of occurred to me this morning as I drove over here, I guess pretty elementary, but an average Iraqi citizen, you know, says, kind of looks at the UN resolutions and looks at the U.S.'s justifications for being in this war, I should say the U.S. government's justifications, and says, well, there are no weapons of mass destruction to get rid of. The Saddam regime is gone. Now leave. I mean, it seems to me that what else are you here for if not to occupy the country? Why aren't you turning it back to us? And, of course, the answer is, wait and see. We have to make sure that stability and order is maintained. And there's a series, of course, of responses, pretexts, and excuses that the U.S. government has over there, but the reality is it has no business being in Iraq. It had no business being there in the first place. It was the Iraqi people's business to get rid of its own tyrants, and admittedly that can be hard in an entrenched dictatorship that's authoritarian, if not totalitarian, and that's a reality. But the kind of sinister involvement that the U.S. has allowed itself to be drawn into, the U.S. people have allowed themselves to be drawn into, using essentially lies or extreme exaggerations by the Bush administration, which has its own political agenda, are essentially now placing, they're killing Iraqi people and American troops are dying. It's a repeat of quagmires in different countries, the most famous of which is Vietnam. And it's interesting, I've kind of been following this on the AP. There's less and less news on the AP about the internal political situation, what the people of Iraq think and what the local groups are doing, and more about how many troops are getting shot and how many troops are shooting how many Iraqis. And it's back to the body count approach of the late 60s and early 70s in Vietnam, as well as the blustering of President Bush, bring it on, which I'm sure many of the listeners are already aware of, but there you are. What we have coming up on the show, as well as some discussion of Iraq and some readings from different sources, some of my favorites, of course, are Counterpunch, and I'm reading a lot from AP News Dispatches. Even mainstream media is covering this stuff. Of course, the Pentagon quickly comes out with the latest fluff and weapons of mass distraction that they have, but the latest being the $25 million reward for Saddam Hussein. And, of course, Saddam Hussein doesn't have too much to do now with what's going on in Iraq. It has to do with the fact that there are American troops in Iraq and that the Iraqi people don't want them there. But I'll be talking about that more later. I'm going to be calling as my first guest Roxanne Acquistapace, and we had Roxanne on the air on numerous occasions. I believe she actually called in last show. She is an expert in CPS advocacy, that is to say the advocates of victims of CPS, or people who are having their children taken away by CPS, often without adequate justification. And we've actually had numerous moms on the show talking about their children being taken. We had Chaya on the show. We had a couple, Orly and his partner were on the show. We've had a variety of folks talking about the kinds of, huge discretion and incredible power that the CPS has in this county. So, let's see if I can get a hold of Roxanne, who's been covering the case of a homeless couple whose four children were taken by CPS. Let's see.
Hello.
What we're doing now. Are we ringing?
Hello?
Roxanne.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Excellent. And I think we can hear you, too.
Am I talking too loud?
No, you're talking fine.
Okay.
So, welcome to Free Radio again.
Thank you, Robert.
And you're, well, you're an advocate for those who are having problems with CPS, is that fair to say?
I am. I'm an advocate for anybody who's either being denied services by the county or being given services that they don't want, such as CPS.
Well, what does that entail? What's the typical case you run into that you would show what the kind of work you do and the kind of problem that exists?
Well, I've had homeless people denied Medi-Cal or denied any services that they were absolutely entitled to, just because a county worker made a determination that. You know, they make crazy determinations. This person isn't really homeless. I can tell by how they're dressed. Things like that. But also services that people don't want, having their children removed from them. And I can't really help people that lose their children, like in the commission of a crime or that kind of thing. But I can help people sometimes once they've completed what the courts ask them to do, and still the social worker will not give them back their children. So those are some examples. I will tell you that the cases run the gamut of experiences. Just when you think you've seen it all, you know.
Well, what kind of cases have you found yourself involved with recently?
Well, most recently has been the case that you're referring to, where a couple came here from Kentucky and immediately had their children removed. They had an altercation with someone in a campground who then turned around and got even with them by calling CPS. And the man has a prescription for medical marijuana, and when he would not share his medical marijuana with someone in the campground, they just, you know, people can be evil. So, but we have some good news on that case. I think I have not been able to get in touch with them, and we've actually been out of touch since court happened a couple weeks ago. But at that court hearing, they were determined that they should get the baby back within a few weeks and the other children shortly thereafter. They had some classes to complete. However, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. How old are the kids?
The children are 3 years old. I think 7, 9, and 11.
Mm-hmm. And these were all taken way back in April?
Yes.
And we're now, of course, going into July. Yeah, go ahead.
It's important that the baby be returned because she had only a few more months where they could have put her up for adoption.
Taken permanently
from this couple.
So when the babies quickly get adopted out more quickly than other children? Or?
Yes. I mean, for parents that want to adopt a child, that is what they would mostly like, is a baby. And, you know, often the parents that they place foster children with are actually fost-adopt parents. That's how the county tricks adoptive parents, people who want to be adoptive parents, into being foster parents, is by telling them if they serve as foster parents, they will place children in their home that are most likely not going back to the parents. So it's a very sad situation because, as you can imagine, a three-year-old is very easily, you know, you can get attached to them. And if you think there's a possibility that that child might become yours, you're even more invested in them. And then when the child leaves, the foster adopt parent has a lot of resentment and heartbreak. So, never a good situation.
Hmm. And how long have you been doing this kind of work, Roxanne?
I've been an advocate for... I think it's 4 years now where I've officially, in my own mind, been doing this. You know, I started as an advocate for foster parents that were in trouble with the county, which happens frequently. And I just branched out. I started an advocacy service that's free from my own home because I realized how often the law is suspended by CPS, how they just do what they feel like doing without proof, without, you know, with incomplete investigations. I don't believe the social workers are even trained to do a real investigation. And I guess the thing that shocks me the most is that when the police or the sheriff's department or the district attorney's office has done an investigation and determined that the case is without merit, CPS can just keep it up. They go above the law. They're a law unto themselves. And they can decide it is with merit with absolutely no proof.
Are they experiencing budget cutbacks, too, or are they proceeding full-blown? You know anything about that?
I'm not certain. I think that all county offices are experiencing budget cutbacks. And it's a very dangerous thing in CPS because you have then social workers with expanded caseloads because they aren't going to replace social workers who leave. And they're already doing a bad job, in my estimation, and now they're going to do worse ones, you know, because they're not even going to have the time that they devoted to a case previously for each case. And unfortunately, I don't think it's going to stop them from taking children. See, to me, when the county cannot provide what a child needs, and they've never done it, the county has never provided what children need. By taking a child, they make the child a special needs child. The children do not get counseling. I've adopted two children. They were 6 and 11 when I adopted them. They never had counseling in all the years that they were in foster care. The youngest one was in foster care from the time she was 18 months old, and the oldest from the time she was 5. They don't give the children counseling until they're just so beaten down, so screwed up, so out of hand behaviorally that, you know, that now the school's insisting they have counseling, or the foster parent or the adoptive parent. So they never provide what the children need, as far as I'm concerned. And they're supposedly taking them away from bad parents. But children suffer terrifically with the system as parents.
What about the claim that's made that somehow CPS makes money by taking children away from parents and essentially, someone said, selling them to adoptive or foster parents?
Well,
is that a true claim, or is that sort of a claim based on...
It's a true claim in this way. When Clinton passed his new adoption law, which was, in his mind, to facilitate, there are many children that stay in the system year after year after year. Their parents never complete the program the court set out for them, and the children go from foster home to foster home, basically, for years and years. Sometimes they're adopted as older adoptive children under special programs through special agencies, but by that time their potential is pretty much shot. The law about children being adopted out, that parents only have 6 months to complete the program that the court and social services has set before them, was meant so that children didn't languish in foster care, that someone would love them and give them a home. But what happened was that California, in the first year of Clinton's law, actually earned $38 million from adoptions because they get, I believe it's, I had heard it was $600 an adoption, but I was informed by a lawyer that it's $6,000 an adoption from the federal government. So I still feel uncertain about those statistics. I have a really bad head for numbers. But the main statistic, which is that California, And as you know, California is in huge fiscal problems right now. In the first year, which was about 4 or 5 years ago, earned $38 million off adopting out children. As, you know, the children being worth so much ahead. There's tremendous incentive to do this. The other thing, and Cecilia Espinola, who's the head of human resources in Santa Cruz, vehemently denies that there's any money in foster care. But what you have to understand, you know, they say, well, you know, all we do is pay foster parents, pay counselors, pay. How can it be advantageous to have, you know, over 5,000 foster children in Santa Cruz County? It's advantageous in this way. Having worked for the county, I understand very well how the county works, and it's this. Your program is considered successful the more it's needed. So even though, yes, we pay out money to foster parents, etc., it costs money to have foster children. It makes the program, it creates the jobs, it makes the program successful. And so whenever you hear the smokescreen that, oh my God, you know, it's not advantageous to us at all to take children, well, it is. It's very advantageous. It's also advantageous because you can take a child who you're pretty sure there's really nothing wrong there, and you can keep them for 3 days to 2 weeks while you're doing an investigation and then just return them, and you get paid for 30 days services for that child. The county does. So they also can realize funds that they don't use, that are then there, tucked away.
Now, is that the state that pays them or the federal government?
Both state and federal government kick in money.
And this figure, you said $38 million in the first year or some such
thing.
Where does that figure come from? Where did you get that?
It came out of the L.A. Times. The L.A. Times did a huge expose on this in their, you know, their Sunday magazine that they put out with their newspaper? And they did a huge expose on Child Protective Services and the adoption laws, and that was their quote was that it was $38 million.
Is that a recent expose or some time ago?
You know, I haven't seen one. I am so busy myself that sometimes keeping track of the statistics, I mean, just because you see so much abuse in your own county,
mm-hmm.
of children and couples, and you know that I'm not even seeing the bigger picture.
How many CPS cases would you say, Roxanne, you've been involved with?
You know, Robert, I don't know. I don't even know if I could estimate.
We're talking dozens, hundreds, thousands.
Oh, I would say serious cases about 20,
mm-hmm.
and other things that get resolved immediately with the writing of a letter or the introduction of a lawyer into the case is the best thing to end it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't always just work on specific cases. I actually lobby the Board of Supervisors, who actually is the boss of Human Resources and Child Protective Services. I've done that without much success, but I still keep doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I find Marty Wormout to be the biggest phony of them all, to practically have tears in her eyes when you come before her and talk about a child that you know. You have to remember that from being a county worker, from being a foster parent, I know many foster children. Mm-hmm. I've known them since they came into foster care.
Mm-hmm.
And when I see them after 12 years in foster care, when they were bright as a button and straight-A students and loved the foster home they were in, that after the social workers move them around like chess pieces, they are not allowed to see their former foster parents, who they may have been very attached to, lived with 4 or 5 years. The habit is, or the custom is, to move a child before they're 13 no matter how well they're doing in a foster home. Because at 13, they have stature under the law to say where they want to be and who they want to be with. And since social workers want to be in control of that, often for no reason at all, right before a child's 13th birthday, the foster parent will get a notice that the child's being moved, a 7-day notice. So,
how many children are actually placed by CPS each year, in your opinion, in Santa Cruz? Do you have any stats?
I understand it's around 5,000 a year.
Mm-hmm. And do we know what the budget of CPS is in a standard
year? I don't know that.
Mm-hmm. And I know we were talking originally about the case that was Orly and Stacy and their four children, the homeless couple who were in a campground and had their kids snatched because of the allegations of medical marijuana use inappropriately.
Yes.
How many of the people you've talked to and of people that you know about, the children that have been taken, are taken from a homeless couple for reasons that have to do with their status rather than, let's say, violence or some such thing that might be a legitimate cause for...
You mean their status as a homeless person?
Yeah, the reality that they live in a vehicle.
Well, that's illegal. So CPS will always, if that would be a social worker's motive, it would always be couched in some other terms. They would have to allege that something else was the problem.
But in your experience, and I understand that that's how they would couch it, since you've investigated some of these cases, at least of the 20 or so cases you've looked into, what percentage of those were homeless?
Robert, actually, this is my first homeless case.
Aha. So it perhaps may not be either, it may not be as frequent as...
Well, this is the thing, Robert. You referred this couple to me.
Yes.
I mean, what I do is spread by word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
I run it out of my own home. I don't have money for advertising. And so I'm not saying, in fact, you know, I had heard that homeless people lost their children frequently. It's just that they weren't referred to me.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't mean it isn't happening. What happens is either a foster parent will have a child placed in their home that they know doesn't belong there, that they know, you know, that the parents are being framed, and they will refer the parents to me and try to take good care of their children till it can be resolved. Foster parents are not allowed to interface with natural parents. In any helping form. There was a fabulous set of foster parents up in Ben Lomond that kept people connected with their children the whole while they were going through the courts. They would have the parents to dinner because CPS only offers a visit once a week for an hour. Stacy and Orly were seeing their 3-year-old once a week for 1 or 2 hours. All in one time. The foster parents don't want to be bothered with several visits a week. The county's afraid of losing the foster parents. And the county doesn't want to supervise the visits. They don't want to provide the personnel. So a 3-year-old can barely stay bonded after they've been gone from their parents for months and months. Well, this couple made sure that the parents stayed invested in their children because parents become so hopeless after a while. They sort of give up. It's actually more painful to see the child, you know. And so this couple, I think, was just fabulous. And the county, you know, set their hat for them when they went into court. When you have a foster child, the foster parent is asked if they have any comments. So to this couple, what happened to them was the social worker was determined to keep the child in foster care. The foster parent felt that the children should be returned. The parents came over and helped the children with their homework. They had dinner with them every night at the foster parent's house, blah, blah, blah. Well, this home was closed down to make it short and sweet. And it wasn't closed down for that reason. They would never give those reasons as the reason. But even though the foster family had just passed their inspection that you have to go through every year of your home, you know, in order to qualify for foster care,
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden, an anonymous complaint came in about their home, and they had to make $80,000 worth of improvements to their home.
I see.
Even though they had just had the complete inspection 4 months previous. But when they went into court and went against the social worker and the judge saw their point of view and the children were returned, their life was never the same.
Wow.
It's dangerous to be a good foster parent, actually. It's very dangerous. If you're willing to just let the children be moved and, you know, not get too involved with them, and, you know, that's the best kind of foster parent the county likes.
We're talking with Roxana Kista Pache, and the name of the advocacy service that you perform is?
Independent Advocacy.
And your phone number for those who want to reach you?
462-5509.
462-5509.
So I'm not a legal entity, but I can help people respond to the court. I can help them by making them aware that they really need to, every time they get a notice of action, there's a certain date by which they have to file an appeal, of helping them get the appeals in. Sometimes I do think that CPS preys on people that have minimal education or a minimal understanding of what's going to happen to them. You know, what I really want people to understand, if you are ever in this situation, is that CPS is not your friend. That many people have been lulled into, oh, I have a really nice social worker and we really get along and, you know, I just tell her everything and blah, 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 blah. And then come to find out their words are haunting them in court.
Yeah, it's interesting. The whole court process, I've been involved in a couple of these cases just as a sort of a friend of the mom. And I used to be allowed into the court by Judge Yance, but then the judge told me that the CPS pressures against him were too strong to do that, because he didn't want to offend them, even though I was there at the request of the mother, just to kind of provide moral support. And the interesting setup is you have the mother, and then on the other side you have like four or five people, including usually one or two attorneys, a huge array of legal firepower against the mom, supposedly advocating for the kids, supposedly advocating for the community and so forth, but all in a closed hearing that no one has access to, even if the mother wants it open. Yeah, presumably even if the mother and the children want it open, that doesn't matter. They don't open it up.
Well, the cloak they hide behind is confidentiality. And supposedly when you went in that courtroom, you know, that you would know who the child is, their full name, etc. It's ridiculous, because the kind of people who want to come into court for the parents are people who know the family. And there's often a gag order put on the parents that they are not allowed to speak about their own case to anyone because of the confidentiality. It is ridiculous. And so it's not, as we saw in Chaya's case, it's not until the parent realizes, my God, they're going to just take my child. I did nothing. And they're going to remove my child, that they start talking to the press, talking to free radio, talking to anyone that will listen. But by then it's too late.
Yeah, there's great pressure. I mean, courts and bureaucratic authorities and police and even your own attorney who's maybe been appointed by the court to help you will advise you to keep a low profile, say nothing, play along, don't offend, and that sort of thing. And it's also true that there is a sort of a narrow line you have to walk, because some of the things that you do can be, you know, held against you, so you have to kind of make difficult choices, right?
Well, you know, it's sad to say, but I've heard so many parents say, I have done nothing wrong, and I'm not afraid to talk about, you know, my life or my this or my that. And, you know, it's like everything, it shouldn't be allowed. I mean, I expect the judges, honestly, to be able to see through county council's trumped up case when they are trumped up, and the law, the actual law, I mean, when it's used in court that a parent has not vaccinated their children, there is no law that a child must be vaccinated. As a matter of fact, when your children go to public school, there's a waiver that you sign if you have not had your children vaccinated so that they can attend school. So all of a sudden, people will find themselves in this maze of accusations that are absolutely not illegal, none of the things that they have done. If they use a homeopathic doctor for asthma, for instance, for their child, it doesn't matter that it works. Medical neglect can be inferred, or actually they can be accused of it, because the child has not seen a Western doctor for their asthma for maybe 5 years. The child may never have had an asthma attack in those 5 years, but that's not the point. The point is to get these parents by making the judge feel that, you know, if the children were returned, they would not get good care.
Now, we haven't got any stats, because these hearings are closed, on how frequently kids are returned to their original parents, or how frequently CPS wins its cases and throws them into foster care and so forth.
No, we don't really have statistics. If you go, you know, even if you walk outside the court, you know, the name on the docket is Miranda. You know, there's no last name, there's no, you know, everything is very, very confidential.
What about the grand jury, which has recently been impaneled, a new grand jury? Is there a chance of getting them to look into this? Have you ever considered using them as an avenue?
Actually, my understanding is that the grand jury has actually indicted CPS a couple times, and nothing's changed in past years, even before I went to work for the county, because I used to say that frequently.
Right.
I've got a lot of hope in the grand jury, because it can be led by the prosecutor. We've been talking with Roxanne Aquista-Pache, who again can be reached at 462-5509. With independent advocacy, Roxanne has been advocating for those whose children have been taken by CPS, and also, as you pointed out, more broadly, who are getting unwanted and unneeded services from the county, or are not getting the services that they do need and want, and they're entitled to. Is that accurate, Roxanne?
Right. It works both ways. You know, there are people that need help from the county and cannot get it, that need Medi-Cal or need food stamps, or, you know. I recently had a man that is terminally ill with hepatitis, and he was absolutely, you know, entitled to Medi-Cal until his SSI kicked in. And, you know, for love nor money, we could not get him on Medi-Cal. He had a social worker that was very difficult to deal with, made him jump through 100 hoops. And by the time he had jumped through them, his SSI kicked in. Now, the disservice to this man was that Medi-Cal goes back 3 months. So he would have had coverage for hospital stays that had happened 3 months prior to him being made eligible for Medi-Cal. And we could not get it done.
Yeah, but think of the savings for the county and the state.
That's exactly it. But now, besides being, you know, dying of hepatitis, he also has a tremendous amount of bills. He will probably lose his house and, you know, end up becoming a homeless hepatitis victim.
Well, then he can move to Fresno, perhaps.
Why? What's Fresno?
Oh, that's the answer that I customarily give out, is what people should do if they're homeless in Santa Cruz, the solution that the folks who are gentrifying the downtown and, you know, criminalizing people for sleeping and all that sort of thing give out. They don't actually put it that way, but they generally say the property values here are too high, that, you know, people should realize that they need to go to a place where it's more befitting of their budget. And actually, Fresno, though, I suppose it's cheaper to live in some ways, may not be cheaper in terms of the jobs available and in terms of other things. But
well, I absolutely have my biggest problem with Child Protective Services in the county is that they seem to be above the law, as are most government agencies. And for instance, the couple that we were talking about, their children came to them at a supervised visit saying they'd been physically abused in their foster home, that they had upset the foster dad, and told a story. The supervising social worker stopped them from talking to their parents about it. Their parents said, well, what do you mean, and started asking them questions. The social worker intervened, told them that was not appropriate conversation for a visit. The parents then called me that evening saying they had gone to the police, to the sheriff's, to check their, to see that their children were okay, because now their children were even more frightened that they had told, you know. They could not get any policeman, any sheriff, to do a well child check on their children in the foster.
What is a well child check?
Well, a well person check is where you call and you say to the police, I've called and called and no one's answered at my old granny's house, you know, and I'm afraid she's fallen on the floor. I'm afraid she's there but can't get to the phone. The police will actually go out and do a well person check. So they had every reason when they could not get their children for the designated phone call that night after the visit to fear for them. They could not get any law agency to go to that home and just make sure that their children were okay.
Well, perhaps like Judge Yonce, they didn't want to offend the CPS
people. That's exactly what they were told.
Hmm.
That is CPS's jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying, well, there's no one in at CPS right now. You know, we want to know that they're safe and not being hurt. The next day, even though the social worker had heard about this at a visit, they did spend the night in that foster home. They were removed, however, the next day. When we went into court, I believe we found out that they had been removed.
So CPS did take the accusations of the kids seriously?
We don't know, because it's confidential. The parents don't know.
And you haven't been able to contact the parents since?
I haven't been able to get them. Their line has been busy each time I've called.
Mm-hmm.
When we get off air, I might give you their number and have you contact them.
Leave it on the Huff line if you could. We're talking with Roxana Kistapache, and for those who want to, you know, get in touch with her, again, her number, Roxanne's number, is 462-5509. Roxanne, I've got a roll. We have another guest coming in or coming up by phone shortly, and I also want to let a little audience participate here, or a large audience. I want to thank you for giving us...
Are you taking calls today?
Yes.
Because when I get off the phone, I will try and reach them, and maybe they can just call in and talk to you themselves.
That would be great.
I'm hoping that the children have been removed, and that's why... been returned, and that's why...
We're talking about Orly and Stacy.
Right. That's why I haven't heard anything.
Listen, thank you, Roxanne, for doing an early Sunday morning deal with us.
Okay.
Hey, appreciate it, and keep up the good work, and keep us informed here.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And indeed, you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm Robert Norse. This is Bathurst Pier's Broadside, Civil Rights until 1 o'clock this afternoon. At 10:30, we're going to have John Gibson of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee calling in. That's a new Santa Cruz group recently formed, actually around the time of the town hall meeting at the Iraqi War, the first town hall meeting in the Civic Auditorium that was so poorly attended, I believe, but was... John Gibson was there, and they've also been tabling on the mall on July 4th, and John's going to give us a report on that. Do you want to call in and get a word in about what you've heard about CPS, civil rights, or you want to talk about other subjects that concern poor and homeless people or concern the community here, and on those issues do? It looks like we got someone doing that. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yeah, hi, Robert. This is David.
Hey, David.
How you doing?
Good.
I'm going to turn my radio down. I hear more.
Sure. You're echoing. Whoa, spooky.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
My wife's from Oaxaca, Mexico, and this is a similar case. In the state of Iowa, we went through there in September 2001, and her cousin, my wife's Chatino Indian from Oaxaca. She speaks English. She's a U.S. citizen. Her cousin, Chatino Indian, like my wife's second language is Spanish, and she had a second child born in Iowa City. The first child born was very, very sick. She provided care for the child. The second child was less sick, and the doctors and the nurses felt that she was basically unable to take care for both children. And from our interpretation, the crux of the problem was that they never provided translation on how to, it was very delicate medical care, translation in Chatino, her first language. They just thought that she spoke Spanish, that Spanish was her primary language. And so they only provided Spanish translation for her. And basically, it's a long story. To make a long story short, CPS with the social services basically took both kids away from her age, you know. You would get them back. And to make a long story short again, they were eventually taken away from them. By the time we arrived in Iowa City, the court possibilities were just about no more possibilities, but we lent money, $5,000. We got this big-time lawyer, and right now the case, I believe, is in this Iowa State Supreme Court, but she has lost all visitation to the kids.
How long ago was this, David?
Well, 2001, the big whammies hit.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then she hasn't had any way to, no contact with her kids since then?
Absolutely nothing. So in the meantime, she had her third kid now, and her brother just called me from San Diego. He moved from Iowa City. He's about to have his first child in 2 weeks. He got so scared of Iowa City that he was going to lose his kid that he and his partner moved to San Diego 2 weeks ago. They're scared of the people there, the state authorities. They're very racist.
Mm.
And in the legal papers, we saw in the court papers, they said that Domitilia was, backwards, something like that, because they gave an IQ test to her in Spanish, which is not her first language.
Mm.
She doesn't speak Spanish well at all. Just rudimentary. Even it's like it doesn't matter if it's so clear the injustice in this court system. The court system is such a, you know how it is. It's so, well, it's an injustice, but your papers weren't filed correctly or blah, 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 you know? It's just, I learned a little bit, it's quite frustrating.
Yeah, I think you really, if you think injustice is being done, you better start, you know, rushing around fast to find, the key is to find other people who've had similar circumstances or to those who are, have had some history, know the, kind of the ins and outs of what's been happening. People like Roxanne, like Keith Tapache, that you probably just heard on the radio. You heard that?
Yes, I heard. That's why I called in, yeah.
Yeah, I think locally, to deal with CPS abuse, you know, folks who've suffered it have to get together in support groups.
Right.
And, you know, try to find ways to, you know, issue press releases, make Public Records Act requests to get information about just what CPS has been doing, and then raise the issue in a way through newspapers, through media, and then through the supervisors and the city councils, and I suppose through those clowns who are in the state legislature and in the federal legislature,
right.
You know, get some kind of action. But first you start at a local level, and you organize, and you speak out. I mean, that's at least what I've done. I've not been terribly successful legislatively. I mean, we're fighting what appears to be at the moment a losing battle around saving public spaces for everyone and stopping the harassment of poor people downtown.
Right.
But it's a battle that has to be fought, and I think the same is true of the CPS situation, even more, of course, if it's your children that are at stake.
Yeah, I agree with you. The challenge in Domitilia's community, they're undocumented workers, immigrants, and so they're very public shy, do you know what I mean? So they're more, it's a double challenge to organize within them, and that's why they're really vulnerable to these CPS workers who you touched upon with Roxanne, that they act like your friend, but they're the biggest backstabber. She thought all along that they were coming to visit her and check her out and blah, blah, blah. One day they saw a bag of empty beer bottles, and it turned out Domitilia's partner in Iowa, they worked as motel workers cleaning motel rooms. They would collect beer bottles to return them for deposit money.
Mm-hmm. And so they were big drinkers, right?
Exactly. They said that he was an alcoholic.
David, so, thank you for the call. Is there more you want to say?
I'm sorry to take every time there.
No, I'm glad. You've given me, it's all valuable information. If you want to call back in the next hour, feel free to do so. I'm kind of up against the clock right now.
Gotcha, man. Keep up the good work, Robert.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Thanks, bye.
Bye-bye. And very quickly, before we catch the next interviewee, I should say, I'm the interviewer. You can catch me easily. I'm right here. Some interesting stuff came over the Indie Media website. That's the San Francisco Indie Media website, which I wasn't able to access earlier this morning, but now I see on the screen the V-Man and other broadcasters for Free Radio probably brought this information up to your attention, but it has to do with attacks on San Francisco Liberation Radio. That's the free radio station in San Francisco broadcasting, gosh, I don't know for how many years, almost as long as we have, if not longer. The FCC has now attacked the micro radio station in San Francisco, the micro power radio station, with threats of $17,000 fines and time in prison. And again, the description on the Indie Media website, sf.indiemedia.org, not our Santa Cruz, but go to Santa Cruz and you can get to SF Indie Media if you have access to the internet, sf.indiemedia.org. San Francisco Liberation Radio 93.7 FM has been broadcasting for 10 years now, basing our authority to broadcast on the right to freely speak and the rights of individuals to have access to a free and diverse media. We have defied the FCC and brought the people of San Francisco a resource that is truly available to those who wish to use it. The station moved across town 1 year ago last May Day, and since then we have received no word from the FCC until now. Last Wednesday, at about 5 p.m., federal agents came and delivered a notice of illegal broadcasting. They were denied entry, although they threatened up to a $17,000 fine and time in jail. We have 10 days to show them either a permit or authority to broadcast. We've been trying to get a San Francisco Board of Supervisors to pass a resolution in support of San Francisco Liberation Radio and Bayview Hunters Point Radio 103.3, apparently another free radio station up there, but have made limited headway. We hope that this latest visit will be the impetus needed for them, the supervisors, to pass a resolution in support of freedom of the media, especially now with the new deregulations having just been passed in the FCC and the media becoming more and more homogenous. We need to show the FCC that this is an issue worth fighting for. A free and diverse media is not a thing of theoretical importance. It is an absolute necessity for a healthy democracy. And it encourages people in San Francisco, call your supervisor, tell them this is an issue you care about and they should support a resolution backing San Francisco Liberation Radio 93.7 and Bayview Hunters Point Radio 103.3 FM against an overbearing FCC with only the health and wealth of corporate media at heart. And then it lists the name, phone numbers, and email addresses of the San Francisco supervisors. And I would encourage those down here who want to go to www.sf.indymedia.org, and click on that story, which is on the right side of the screen, about the fourth or fifth story down, and then send off some emails to these supervisors telling them that you are visitors to San Francisco. When you come up, you appreciate having a Liberation Radio station there, that you are also folks whose own city council in Santa Cruz in 1997, with only Cynthia Matthews dissenting, I think it was 77, maybe it was in 99, but it was anyway in the last six or seven years, has passed a resolution supporting Free Radio Santa Cruz. So it's been done in other jurisdictions. It recognizes the accomplishments and the value of a free radio station to the community generally, even those who oppose our views, like Councilmember Mike Rotkin, favor our right to broadcast, to his credit. And we don't want to lose San Francisco Liberation Radio because, frankly, when they go, we're next. I mean, they can go after Liberation Radio, they're going to go after us. They already have tried to go after us in the past. And, well, I've talked about this on the air and so have others, and we have an emergency sort of system we've set up here that encourages people to come down to the station if the FCC tries an attack on the station, which may happen at any time. And so we may have to go back into that emergency status again. It looks like, in fact, the Free Radio Collective will be meeting today to discuss that. And we have a phone call. Let's see what we got here. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Is everything all right in there, Robert?
Everything is okay.
Oh, good. I just heard you talking about it. I thought you were being attacked by the FCC. I was ready to hop on my bike and get down there.
No, but you keep your pedals hot.
Ready.
Hey, got some urine bottles ready to go.
Yeah.
Want the FCC to know that.
Mamma mia. You know, Skidmark, have you heard more about what's happened with San Francisco Liberation Radio?
Nope, I haven't heard too much more about it.
I mean, we heard about this Wednesday warning. Is there any...
It sounds like they're normal harassment around this time of year, personally. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, we have our own problems with this Christian radio station that coincidentally just happened to pop up on 96.3.
Well, we need a little religion. This is Sunday, you know.
That's true. I don't know why you're not talking about the good Lord.
Well, I am the good Lord, and I'm talking, man, so keep that in mind.
The Lord behind the robe.
Yes, sir. I've got my credentials, and I'll show them to you if you want later.
Okay, I'll see you.
All righty.
All right, bye.
And looks like, yeah, I hope that Skidmark is right, that we have simply... this is, you know, the usual, batter at the doors of the San Francisco and the various free radio stations, but there are stations that have been shut down recently. They've actually, some were unwise enough to let people into their station. The rule for us here is FCC knocks, go get a search warrant, you know, we're not going to open up. Other stations have been foolish enough to allow these bureaucrats in. I mean, it seems like whether it's CPS or FCC, the amount of real public responsibility these purportedly, representative or responsible agencies have is very limited, or, you know, they're working in the opposite direction. Of course, it's no surprise, considering we're dealing with corporate media and a conservative ethic in the CPS situation, which is more than conservative. It's a bureaucratic, sort of self-perpetuating group of individuals who expand their jobs. I mean, I guess that happens with any bureaucracy. So I'm going to even without a musical break, which I wish we had a moment for, in fact, I think we will take a brief musical break and hope that we have a little time for that, and then we'll try to get a call. A call-in from John Gibson of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, who's has got some interesting stories for us about tabling downtown and also, of course, about what he's tabling for, which is to restore the Bill of Rights in Santa Cruz, to get the Santa Cruz City Council to put some teeth into opposition to the Patriot Act, and to point out the connections. I hope this is even more done even more than has been done before, the connections between national repression and local repression, where local repression can mean repression from, for example, political tailors. It can mean ticketing people or arresting people for trying to show a video on the sidewalk in a traditional manner, which has never been objected to before by police, but now apparently at the behest of private businesses like the Pacific Trading Company, which don't want to have videos out there in front of their stores, exposing the practices of their businesses and the collusion with the city to eliminate, say, seating space for poor people. They don't want that shown. So times are getting more repressive, and we'll be getting on to John shortly. But before we do, let's hear this.
Since I've had a raise in pay, way things are going, I could get laid off any day. Sure is hard living with all this pain. I know what I need. I need somebody to blame. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some gold.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Let's send them back.
My neighborhood library is about to close. The school my kids go to is becoming a joke. Self-serving liberals blame it on corporate tax breaks. But that's propaganda. I know who I should hate. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
We got some gold.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
We got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Let's get them back.
Who's to blame for the potholes and flooding and drought?
It's all their fault. It's all their fault.
Who's to blame for inflation, unemployment, and everything I'm pissed off about? Who's to blame for the end of the good old days? Who's to blame for the fact that I can't get laid? Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Send them back. Send them back. Send them back.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some gold.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
On drugs. And I hope that's a lesson to all you teenage welfare immigrant mothers on drugs, for heaven's sakes. This is an old cut from Dave Lippman. Dave Lippman of Urgent Records, way back in the, actually it was not that far away, 98. I Hate Walmart, good CD, and I recommend it. We're going to be hearing shortly from John Gibson of the Bill of Rights Committee. He called during the musical break, and he'll be calling back. So stay tuned, and we're going to be talking about that. And while we are waiting for him, that is, I am going to, well, kind of bring up the City Council agenda. Maybe we can talk about that. City Council has a meeting on Tuesday, a rather unusual meeting. I'm trying to get to the screen here on the computer that actually gives you the City Council agenda. People can do that, or they can check it out in the library, which is open on Sundays. The website to go to is look for City of Santa Cruz using a Google engine, and then check under Next Meeting over in the kind of the right side of the screen, and you'll be able to see what the City Council has in store for you, or get some inkling of what they have in store for you. It's actually pretty cut and dried, and not terribly encouraging. The City Council has a meeting, as I said, on July 8th. It starts at 10 a.m. earlier. That's actually the closed session. The closed session usually starts like at 12 or 1. But they're starting it early because apparently they want to end it early. I'm not quite clear. I mean, they apparently have some meeting in the evening, or maybe they're all taking off to, you know, buy lingerie at the Pacific Trading Company. It's not clear what the point is. There are usually the meetings are at 3 o'clock and at 7 o'clock. The afternoon session is at 3 and the evening session is at 7, with oral communications at 7 o'clock, when you can actually speak before the City Council for 3 minutes, unless Mayor Riley decides to interrupt you or butt into line or enforce decorum rules that she has suddenly reinterpreted in order to protect the ears of the young at home, or perhaps the business profits of the Pacific Trading Company down on the mall. And Mayor Riley has an unusual set of priorities. But today we have an unusual time, I should say today, Tuesday, we have an unusual time set. And the time, it starts at 1:30, the City Council's what's called consent agenda and administrative business, which is usually at the 3 o'clock session in the afternoon. And what you have, instead of having, you have no evening session at all, and no redevelopment agency, which is often at 5 o'clock for those who want to see what happens to the money that's supposed to go for affordable housing projects and other things, but ends up funding a very right-wing, gentrification-minded, in-the-pocket-of-mercy housing Redevelopment Agency, which has no oversight. There's no oversight agency for the Redevelopment Agency in Santa Cruz. But there's no such meeting today. Usually at 5, there's no meeting. The meetings start, as I said, at 1:30 on it's July 8th. I keep saying today, but it is July 8th, Tuesday, day after tomorrow. And it goes probably until 5 or 6. And the trouble with the oral communication situation is there is no oral communications at any particular time. You have to wait until the end of the meeting. There's no time certain for oral communications. Of course, this is an obvious way to discourage people who are trying to talk. But we have somebody we're not going to discourage. We have a man calling in. What's your name, sir?
It's John Gibson, Robert.
Hey, John.
Hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Now, you're with this questionable new organization, which I'm hoping that John Ashcroft and Mayor Riley have under observation, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee?
The Santa Cruz Bill of Rights Defense Committee, correct.
Uh-huh. Now, when you say Santa Cruz, are you part of a nationwide series of kind of committees, or is this independent?
Yeah, we're a grassroots committee. There are, I don't know the exact number, but somewhere around 100, maybe more by now, all over the country that have sprung up in direct, you know, reaction to the Patriot Act.
The Patriot Act. Summarize the Patriot Act passed, I guess, in the fall of 2001.
Yeah, October of 2001.
Uh-huh. What are the main provisions of it that concern you?
The biggest problem with it is, briefly, it creates a new crime called domestic terrorism, which is defined as acts dangerous to human life. They're a violation of the criminal laws of the United States or of any state, and that appear to be intended to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion. And this is supposed to keep us safe from airplanes flying into buildings somehow.
Mm.
The problem with it is, you listen to that definition. I mean, the first thing that came to mind when I read that was acts of civil disobedience fit very neatly into that definition.
Read the definition again, could you, John?
Sure. It's domestic terrorism defined as acts dangerous to human life. They're a violation of the criminal laws of the United States or of any state, and that appear to be intended to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion.
So let's say if you block traffic during an anti-war protest, this might be considered dangerous to your life anyway, human
life. Yeah, at the very least, yeah.
And then you are arrested for that. You could be considered a domestic terrorist, huh?
Correct. And then once you're branded a domestic terrorist, then your civil liberties, your rights under the Bill of Rights and the Constitution start disappearing.
And what rights begin to disappear?
Well, for one thing, you know, it's like you can be arrested without probable cause. If they decide you're a domestic terrorist, they can contact the local library and say they want to look at the material you've been checking out of the library. And the librarian is by law, by the Patriot Act, which was signed into law by Congress, the librarian is required to give that information, and they are not allowed to call you and tell you that the FBI is interested in you or looking at what you're reading. So that's, you know, it's an unreasonable search and seizure. You know, it violates about 5 or 6. And I'm not a constitutional lawyer, I want to make that clear up front. I'm just a guy, and pretty much, you know, everybody in the committee are just, you know, normal citizens, and we're not, you know, completely well versed on what's going on. But it's the more you read about this and investigate it, the more obvious it becomes that this thing is designed to water down, at the very least, water down the Bill of Rights.
I think it's important to, that's why I'm asking these specific questions,
sure,
for us to understand what particular rights you lose once the federal government, if your description here is accurate, has designated you as a domestic terrorist. And I believe there are websites, and you can sort of go through the Google search machine on the internet to find out. At least I know that was the case way back in 2001 when I was looking at this bill's, even as it was being considered. They can give you specifics. I think the ACLU may have.
And there's another. National, what's considered the National Bill of Rights Defense Committee, is a place called New Hampton, and they have a fairly comprehensive website, which is where I kind of got started, you know, researching. And it's it's www.bordc.org. BORDC stands for Bill of Rights Defense Committee. So www.bordc.org. patriotac.org. And you get on there, and you can actually, you can download a copy of the Patriot Act. You can get download a copy of proposed Patriot 2. You know, there's just a whole lot of information that you can, you know, that you can access off of there.
Yeah,
but as far, yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm just interested in, I think what people need is like a one-page summary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've seen this, even in the mainstream media way back then, of the rights you lose under the new...
If you've got a minute, I can give you
a
list right now.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, wiretapping phones. Information collected about you through tapping your phone or computer can be given to the CIA without a court order and without your knowledge. Secret searches of homes. The government can enter and search your home without your knowledge or probable cause. Okay. The reading, I just mentioned that already. The FBI can demand your library, give them a list of all the books you've borrowed or your local bookstore as well, and or bought, you know, and this can be, this is done without informing you. Labeling civil disobedience and activist groups. The Patriot Act broadly, this is repetitive, but expands the definition of terrorism, so civil disobedience or activism could very well be labeled terrorism.
Let me interrupt you for just a moment.
Yeah.
Has that been done with any groups involving civil disobedience in the last 2 years? Because there are going to be those who said, you would say, well, you know, that could be done, sure, but it hasn't been done, so what's the reason for the alarm?
Yeah, I can't answer that definitively right now. I will be able to, I believe, after next Monday. We've got a guy researching some specific cases. We understand it has been done, but I don't want to give anybody, I don't want to start telling things that aren't true, that I don't know to be true. So we're in the process. So we've been around a couple months as all this group. We have about between 40 and 50 people on our mailing list currently, you know, they're, you know, members of the group. We'd love to see, you know, you talk about in the opening of the show, you said, you know, the FBI, I hope John Ashcroft has my, knows who we are. You know, I hope that when he does, that when they do come to call, we can just, you know, when they ask for a list of who we are, I'd love to be able to hand them the local telephone book. Yeah, we'd like to have it. We believe that everyone should become a member of this group, of this committee, simply because it's unlike, you know, if we lose our, if we lose our ability to speak freely, if we lose, if this turns into a police state, then, you know, you can forget about protesting wars. You can forget about, you know, any other type of activism you could name.
Yeah, well, of course, there are those of us who believe we already are in a police state.
Yeah.
In many aspects, for example, I'm going to trial for chalking no war in the street under a non-existent code section for defacing the sidewalk when I wasn't even on the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
There are activists who are, I'm going also going to trial for playing a television set with a video about police abuses on the street, and what has all been a traditional venue for doing that. I mean, Santa Cruz,
mm-hmm.
you set up a battery and a television on the street, and people have played videos for the last 3 or 4 years and longer,
yeah.
no interference, and now that, of course, is being stopped by Sergeant Baker and others of the Santa Cruz Police Department.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a very serious matter, and I'm glad you're looking into it, and I think we've, of course, seen the expansion of the downtown ordinances against poor homeless people, street performers, that essentially give police such broad powers of discretion, kind of analogous locally
mm-hmm.
to the broad powers of defining as a terrorist nationally and internationally that the federal government has. Or am I drawing this analogy too broadly?
Well, in my opinion, we were down there over the week on the 4th, Friday. Yeah, and we set up a table in front of Borders. Actually, we initially set it up in front of Newley's, and we were in, I don't know who the officer was, but he came by and informed us that we were too close to an eating area and too close to, you had to be 10 feet from this, 10 feet from that, and whatever. So we moved to in front of Borders, where he said it was, you know, okay, and was told we could only stay an hour. So we were there for a couple hours and had no intention of, moving. I'm not necessarily prepared to go to jail at this moment for having a table, but, had they ticketed us, you know, we would fight it. I mean, the First Amendment, you know, guarantees you, the right to assemble, right to free speech, and to say that you have the right to free speech but only for an hour just doesn't seem right. I would agree with you that there, you know, I mean, there definitely is a, seems to be, seems a bit ironic, actually, that, or maybe hypocritical. hypocritical is a better word, because the city council did pass a resolution condemning the Patriot Act on constitutional grounds, and they did that after they passed their, I don't know if it was before or after, but it was in November of 2000, I guess, so, 2002 rather, sorry.
Yeah, it was.
It was in the middle of,
but they initially passed the ordinances, then they changed them again in January,
okay.
Passed some more.
Okay, anyways, but it's the same, you know, and there, I mean, the whole idea of, you know, there were people down there that were, you know, breaking, they were talking about, I went to these hearings and these, that the council had and on this, and I spoke against these ordinances when they personally, as a person, not as a member of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. We didn't even exist then. But yeah, I would say that you're probably not far off the mark. They seem very, I'm getting the same feeling from this, you know, this increased police activity and these increased laws. We have way too many laws in this country. Obviously, you can't live in a free country with so many laws.
And you were actually prepared to put your buttocks where your mouth is, so to speak, in a sense, when you said, you know, we have our table for petitioning and literature. I assume that's what you had on your table for the Bill of Rights.
Yeah, exactly right.
And you weren't going to move if the police officer came back and told you to move after an hour, and you said the police officer kind of walked back and forth but didn't bother you.
He didn't walk back and forth. Actually, we didn't see him for about 2 hours, and then he came over and actually handed me a copy of the ordinances that he had been describing to me earlier, and said that, you know, just for future reference, if you plan to be out here in the future, which we do, there's an hour time limit, and you will be ticketed, he said that today we're giving people a break because it's July 4th.
Giving people a break. So it's interesting, the kind of police discretion, they decide when they're going to enforce the law and when they're not, and of course, when we were out there tabling in front of the Pacific Trading Company, they were regularly there at the 59-minute mark.
Yeah.
You know, in some cases, looking at their watches, three strong, standing next, you know, within 15 feet of the table, ready to come in and demand we move or pounce on the table. In fact, a week ago Monday, they took one man away in handcuffs and his table and the stuff that was on it, although I think we removed most of the stuff. And then when I set up an ironing board, seven squad cars and eight police officers and one lieutenant, Lieutenant Lee Sepulveda, came down and demanded I move after an hour after that display device had been up. So apparently you got off easy. I mean, are you paying off the cops here, John? What's going on?
No. No, I don't know.
You're good looking. Could that be the reason?
Yeah, that's it, Robert. Yeah, I don't know. You know,
are they afraid of the Bill of Rights?
Well, I'm hoping that that's it because it may be that, you know, I mean, the guy, he was very, you know, very pleasant, very polite about it, and it may be that he's just, you know, they were giving people a break on the 4th. I don't know. I mean, were you down there on the 4th? Did anybody else get hassled on the 4th?
I wasn't there on the 4th. I know that on the 4th I heard they were massively surveilling and searching people up near Twin Lakes Beach. Huge amounts of people being stopped and searched and, you know, you can't be here or you have to leave and we're going to search you, and, you know, which seemed to me clear infringements of basic constitutional rights. I guess they got some kind of authorization from local governments, but, you know, I don't know how you can get authorization from local governments to engage in those kinds of searches when they violate the Fourth Amendment.
Right.
Maybe they can cite the Patriot Act. I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's the bottom line for us is that the law of the land is the Constitution and its Bill of Rights, and the Patriot Act, pretty much overturns, four or five of the First Ten Amendments. You know, it pretty much makes them null and void under certain circumstances, and that is, from our point of view, the Patriot Act, those provisions in the Patriot Act are constitutionally illegal and need to be challenged. They need to be gone. You know, you can't take and enact a law that eviscerates the law of the land. Okay, you just can't do that if you want to keep. You know, without the Constitution, we're no longer a free country.
Well, I know that you also have been concerned with the failure of the city council to do other than pass a kind of pro forma Hearts and Flowers, oh, we're against the Patriot Act, but we're not going to do anything about it, whereas places like Arcata, the city of Arcata, California, have actually passed a law or a resolution which directs its employees not to cooperate with the Patriot Act. I know, isn't that accurate?
Yeah, that's good. And that's what we were after. That was what our petition was about. We are asking the city council to put the teeth back into its. They had when they originally wrote this their resolution. The teeth were in there. They were instructing the police and city employees to refuse to cooperate with the FBI regarding with any act allowed under the Patriot Act that violates the Constitution or violates your rights. And they took it out at the, we're told, their lawyer suggested they needed to take it out for various reasons. And so we're asking them to put it back in. And I was been speaking to a woman named Valerie Lasiak, who was one of the original authors of that resolution. She's been in touch with Scott Kennedy and tells me that they have been looking into how Arcadian did what they did with the idea of putting the teeth back into it. I've spoken to Scott Kennedy recently, and he has graciously agreed to be at our next meeting. And our next meeting is Monday, the 14th, at the city library upstairs.
Yeah, what time?
At 6 o'clock, between 6 and 8. So and everyone's welcome.
We're talking with John Gibson of the Santa Cruz Bill of Rights Defense Committee.
Yes.
And John, you just told us that you're meeting tomorrow at 6 p.m., second floor of the library, with council member and vice mayor Scott Kennedy in attendance.
Yeah, he told me he would be there. He wrote down the date and time and promised he'd be there. So
I should warn you, this is the man who championed the downtown ordinances both in 1999 and in 2002 and 2003. Right. So he may be sympathetic to putting a little, we won't cooperate nationally, but I don't think he's going to instruct the police to respect civil rights locally unless he's changed his position. So
we're take one step at a time here, and hope he shows up. And I can tell you that we have right around 700 signatures on this already.
Wow. How many hours were you out there totally?
We've been doing this for a few weeks now, but we collected in about 2 hours we collected about 100 signatures Friday. And so we intend to be back out there until we get
gotten any reports from Arcata about how they're resolution is working? I mean, is it? I'm a supporter of symbolic resolutions, but I'm just wondering, have they actually made specific instructions? As I understand, the library autonomously decided to do that. I think the library made some independent decision. At least they announced the policy. Admittedly, they announced it a year and a half late. They didn't announce that they were, about the stuff about the Patriot Act until a year and a half later. So if your books were being surveilled by the FBI, you weren't going to know, until a year and a half later. And even then, of course, unless the library is willing to engage in civil disobedience and say, call the people up and say, we are going to tell you, you're being looked at by the FBI. We're still not going to know. But what's happening in Arcata that you know of, or have you heard anything from them?
Nothing. No specific examples that we know. We've got someone looking into things like that, and we're hoping to get a report from that individual on at this meeting on Monday, and make a flyer and be like you were talking about, and be able to hand out. Okay, here's what happened to John Smith, from Santa Cruz, and here's what happened to so and so, and specific cases with factual examples of stuff. And the thing of it is, though, it's like, if you give the government any kind of power, is there ever not? Do you think there's any chance whatsoever that they're not going to use it? They abuse they don't even have the power. When they don't have the power to invade your privacy, et cetera, they do it and they have to be taken to court and what have you. To actually give them, the power under the so-called Patriot Act and expect that, and have someone use that as an argument and say, they show me an instance where they've used it and then maybe I'll believe you. Well, there will be one, even if it hasn't happened yet, you can guarantee that they will. There's a reason they enacted this legislation, and I don't believe it had a whole lot to do with, terrorism.
Well, I think you've seen, John, kind of nationally and internationally, the massive abuse that the terrorist excuse is used to justify mobilizing the country behind a foreign war, for example, in Iraq, which really is more like a domestic election approach. Mm-hmm. That's one. Some people have seen it that way. Other people think that, this is simply a way of rallying people around federal power, Republican federal power, Republican Party, right-wing Republican federal power, and kind of mobilizing everybody to lockstep march right along, although that hopefully seems to be falling apart as more Iraqis and Americans are getting shot down, and, you know, we got Saddam is gone, the weapons aren't there, but there we are, you know, for the foreseeable future in this rat hole quagmire. And again, I think the excuse used was the same excuse used for the Patriot Act, terrorism. And people are going to say, oh, no, it wasn't an excuse, you know, they ran their planes into the Trade Center. We're at war.
All these polls are done, they say, you know, 42%, I don't even know what the percent, but a large percentage of Americans at one point believed that there were Iraqis on those planes, you know, that they had something to do with it. CIA came out and said they had nothing to do with it, you know, and there's still some people that actually believe, you know, want to continue to make the connection. I mean, you know, it's, yeah, this whole, and remember, too, that the Patriot Act was voted into law, not just by Republicans, by Democrats and Republicans alike. Sam Farr voted against it, but Anna Eshoo voted for it, and, you know, it's, I mean, you know, I don't know what to, you know, what you would call it, but I mean, when you vote into law something that seeks to eliminate the law of the land, I mean, this is exactly what these guys aren't supposed to be doing. All right? They're supposed to be protecting. They take an oath to protect and defend the Constitution from
all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Yeah, foreign and domestic. Thank you. And you know, so. And then to vote the Patriot Act in. I mean, anybody who voted for it needs to, at the very least, be voted out of office, you know. But you can't just blame, and that's the problem. You know, the big problem here isn't that this Republican Congress is doing what they want. It's that the Democrats have, you know, the other part, have laid down and let them do what they want. They've helped them, you know. We're in big trouble here.
No, it's the same is true locally. People like Scott Kennedy, Rotkin, all these folks who are, you know, like to sound, and indeed are, liberal on national and international issues, although we can't seem to get a resolution out of Kennedy or Rotkin or any of these other council members about asking that the Kent City Council support the U.S. getting the hell out of Iraq now. That resolution has gone to them repeatedly, and they've buried it. Who knows? Maybe they'll finally get some nerve up as, you know, if enough Democratic Party candidates start calling for it, then they'll, you know, they'll surf the Democratic Party opinion instead, of course, leading it, which is what we need to do, which is what you're doing on the Patriot Act.
Right.
You know, on abolition of the Patriot Act. I don't think we just need abolition of the Patriot Act and you know, quashing this Patriot Act, too. We need to restore, you know, basic constitutional rights to folks who have been denied them at a local level. I'm thinking, of course, of poor people, but, I mean, there are other groups, too, that have, you know, that face this incredible, massive police power at the state level, where police officers have all kinds of rights that other people don't.
Yeah, hey, I got a question for you, Robert. Mm-hmm. Where is the ACLU as far as your, you know, local issues are concerned? Where I haven't heard that, you know, there's any big lawsuits. Are you being represented by the ACLU?
No.
For instance?
No, the ACLU locally, people like Bob Tarrin and Isabel Gilmore and other ACLU people who are good nationally. It's the same problem. Their connections with Santa Cruz City Council people are too close, or their antipathy to activists like myself and others are too strong, or they see it as too, you know, unwieldy an issue. It's in a way what the ACLU is like in the, you know, in the late 40s regarding the Red Scare, or in the early 70s regarding the rights of people incarcerated in psychiatric institutions. They, you know, the ACLU had no problem with incarcerating people against their will in psychiatric institutions until the mid-70s, when they finally took stronger positions on that. We're in the same position with respect to poor and homeless people, at least locally. In San Francisco and in some cities, the ACLU does support the right of, for example, organizations to feed homeless people, which Santa Cruz, it's been pretty quiescent in Santa Cruz, that particular issue, but Santa Cruz, you know, does not let you sleep. As you probably know, there's a sleeping ban after 11 o'clock at night. And there's massive restrictions on sitting, on holding up a sign in Santa Cruz if you're a spirit changer, unless you are a musician seeking a donation, which is, of course, a constitutional violation. You can't have people allowed to solicit for one purpose but not for another. You know, you can't have content-based restrictions, but that's the kind of stuff that Scott Kennedy and Mike Rotkin voted for. and continue to support. In fact, we're going to be talking later in this show about those downtown ordinances that you opposed last year and the fact that the city council is violating its pledge to bring them back and re-examine them, which it promised to do after 6 months when it passed the latest version of them in January 2003. I kind of went around about way and talked about some other things, but the ACLU, we'd love to have them join in and, you know, assist, but, you know, they didn't even speak against the ordinances in the summer of 2002 and in January of 2003.
Yeah, because this really ties in with, I am not a professional activist. This is not what I do, all right? I'm a caterer, all right? But I want to have the right to go out and, you know, if I choose to speak out against something, you know, the war, for instance, whatever, I want to have the right to do that without fear of being arrested or just for simply speaking out, that kind of thing. I do not want to live in a police state.
Well, just don't jaywalk on your way back from a protest as I did on February 15th after that massive march up, I don't know if you were in that march on Santa Cruz where 3,000 to 7,000 people marched up Mission Street to the park.
No, I wasn't, actually.
It was huge. It was the biggest demonstration I've seen in San Francisco in many a moon. But when I walked back, I jaywalked. I didn't jaywalk. I walked across the street. Actually, it wasn't jaywalking because it wasn't between two stoplights.
Mm-hmm.
And I was stopped by the police and told I couldn't do that. And I said, no, I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they gave me a ticket, and we've been fighting it in court for the last 6 months. So there is selective enforcement going on all over the place. And I'm glad that, you know, you raise the issue of the national and the significance in the local, because a lot of people are upset about what Ashcroft and Bush and Ridge are doing, but they don't give a damn about what Riley and Chief Belcher and Diane Shoemaker, the head of the Parks and Rec Department, and the other local agencies that impact poor people every day, and political activists, too, are doing in our own town. And I know that your group hasn't quite taken that up yet as a specific issue, but I think a lot of you have some concerns about it. Is that a fair thing to say?
I have spoken to a few other members, and I can tell you that I have concerns about it. I'm not going to speak for anyone else right now because it's not something we really just formed a few months ago, and we are specifically targeting dealing with the abuses of the Patriot Act and Homeland Security, the things that are happening on a national level and how they affect us locally. And there's such a huge amount of frustration on the part of, these are people, so many people come out of the